logic, scientific observation,
philosophy of language,
the lives and ideas of the Vienna Circle.
All the clocks in the city began to whir and chime. Oh, let not time deceive you. You cannot conquer time.
Should philosophy be grounded in science?
In logic?
In a theory of meaning and language?
In headaches and in worry, vaguely life leaks away. And time will have his fancy, tomorrow or today.
What's the best way to put philosophy on a solid scientific foundation?
There are lots of ways you could test certain claims.
Our guest is David Edmonds, author of The Murder of Professor Schlick, The Rise and Fall of the Vienna Circle.
People somehow shouldn't be allowed to get away with making those claims and then not being open to scrutiny.
Coming up on Philosophy Talk.
Is metaphysics just a bunch of nonsense?
Is it okay to believe something you could never prove?
Could logic be a solution to the world's problems?
Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Josh Landy.
And I'm Ray Briggs. We're coming to you from our respective living rooms via the studios of KALW San Francisco.
Continuing conversations that begin at Philosopher's Corner on the Stanford campus, where Ray teaches philosophy and I direct the Philosophy and Literature Initiative.
Today we're thinking about the lives and ideas of the Vienna Circle.
Oh, right. You mean that group of Viennese philosophers from the 1920s, people like Max Schlick, Rudolf Carnap, Kurt Gödel?
Yeah, they believed that science and logic are the best tools for understanding the world, and that meaningful claims are the ones that can be verified by experiment, and that a lot of metaphysics is meaningless, like all that stuff about God.
All that stuff about, I mean, I get it that we can't verify whether God exists or not, but does that really mean it's nonsense? I mean, you know, if you're talking about God saying this or that, people might disagree, but they understand what you mean. How could it be meaningless?
Well, you just said it yourself. We can't verify whether God exists. So that means the existence of God doesn't change anything. The philosophers in the Vienna Circle thought that for something to be meaningful, it had to make a difference to what we can see and hear and touch.
Well, okay, maybe, but none of that proves that God doesn't exist.
That's exactly the point. You can't prove or disprove God's existence, any more than you could prove or disprove the existence of the Loch Ness Monster. That's the whole problem.
Yeah, you're starting to sound like Karl Popper.
Well, yeah, he was a friend of the Vienna Circle.
Well, that's not making me more of a fan. I mean, Popper had this weird idea that good theories must always be falsifiable. Like, if nothing could ever possibly disprove them, they're clearly bogus, like astrology or something.
Well, what's wrong with that? Theories are only meaningful if they can be tested through observation.
That's a nice idea. I'm just not convinced it's true. I mean, okay, you like math, right?
Yeah, you bet. It's one of the few sources of certainty in my life.
Okay, well, would you say that maths can be tested through observation? I mean, is there any experiment that could ever possibly convince you that 2 + 2 doesn't equal 4?
Well, okay, no, but that's because mathematical statements are true by definition.
Whose definition? I mean, what if two different mathematicians have different ways of defining their terms?
Well, they could both be right. A lot of philosophers in the Vienna Circle thought that truth was relative.
Wait a minute. I thought you were saying that they're all about science and objectivity. Now you're telling me they're a bunch of pomo relativists?
Not exactly. They didn't think that just any old way of looking at things was as good as any other. Look, a theory is better if it makes more observable predictions. So, for example, like the periodic table is a really good scientific framework because it let us predict the weight of a beryllium atom before we could even measure it.
Yeah, and that was very cool. I grant you that. The problem is, though, I'm not sure it's, strictly speaking, observable. I mean, you can't, like, weigh an atom in your hand. You have to use all this fancy scientific instrument stuff and do all kinds of complicated calculations. You practically need a whole theory of chemistry just to interpret the results.
Okay, there are definitely some details to iron out, but the philosophers of the Vienna Circle had a lot to say about these issues. And I bet our guest, David Edmonds, can fill us in. His new book is The Murder of Professor Schlick, The Rise and Fall of the Vienna Circle.
But who were these Vienna Circle people anyway? We sent our roving philosophical reporter, Holly J. McDeed, to find out. She files this report.
In a nutshell, the Vienna Circle was a group of scholars who got together in Vienna to talk. And at the beginning of the 20th century, there was a lot to talk about.
Theories, for example, Einstein's theories of relativity, you know, were making a splash.
Jordi Cad is a professor of history and philosophy of science at Indiana University. In 1915, Albert Einstein had published his general theory of relativity.
So that attracted all these scientists and intellectually informed and curious and ambitious scientists to actually, you know, become also a bit of philosophers.
You're late.
Well, I was invited at precisely the time I was supposed to arrive here, therefore it was impossible for me to be here when I left.
But...
That's from the film Einstein and Eddington. Arthur Eddington was an English scientist who championed Einstein's ideas even as England stood by their beloved Isaac Newton. England and Germany were at war, and Britain had banned the circulation of German scientific literature.
This stupid and futile war killed him. Expelling German scientists, it won't bring any one of the Cambridges back.
Eddington!
The pursuit of truth in science transcends national boundaries. Takes us beyond hatred and anger and fear. It is the best of us.
What truth? That there are no rules, no standards, no moral absolutes, that you break all the rules of science and replace them with nothing? What does your Einstein want?
He wants what I want. A new theory of gravity.
The members of the Vienna Circle were also grappling with the horrors of war.
Which I think motivated members of the Vienna Circle to say, you know, we really need to dig deep here and start rebuilding our culture.
George Reisch is the author of How the Cold War Transformed Philosophy of Science to the Icy Slopes of Logic. He says the idea was this: devastation beyond all imagination could have been avoided if people were more prone to thinking clearly and scientifically.
And we are going to handle the philosophical side of that by promoting a new philosophy.
But lies were also spreading rapidly. Nazism swept through Europe and many members of the Vienna Circle fled, some to the United States. But during World War II and its aftermath, there was little appetite for philosophers who wanted to shake up American higher education and philosophy. Loose lips, they say, sink ships.
In times of war, people change. Something happens to culture. And one thing that happens is people don't like anything that could be perceived as subversive or disunifying to the national mission.
Instead, the movement focused on the nature of language, and Reisch says the Vienna Circle can still teach us a lot about how to grapple with false and dangerous ideas.
To see how this movement of philosophers and allied intellectuals were grasping in their, dealing in their own ways with, you know, as we would call it now, misinformation, propaganda.
But then again, if most people switched from reading propaganda online to reading the philosophy of the Vienna Circle, we'd probably be living in a different reality right now. For Philosophy Talk, I'm Holly J. McDeed.
That would indeed be a great improvement. Thanks for that fascinating report, Holly. I'm Josh Landy. With me is my Stanford colleague, Ray Briggs. And today we're thinking about the lives and ideas of the Vienna Circle.
We're joined now by David Edmonds. He's a senior research associate at the Uehiro Center for Practical Ethics at the University of Oxford. He's also a co-producer of the Philosophy Bites podcast and the author of The Murder of Professor Schlick, The Rise and Fall of the Vienna Circle. Dave, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Thanks, Ray, and hi, Josh.
Hi, Dave. So, Dave, you have this fantastic podcast that talks about all kinds of topics from free will to paradoxes, even swear words. So what got you interested in a group of philosophers from 1920s Europe?
I guess there were two reasons. The first is that my first book, which was called Wittgenstein's Poker, was about a clash between two brilliant philosophers, Wittgenstein and Karl Popper. And Vienna was kind of the background to the dispute between them. And so that's when I first got into the Vienna Circle. The second reason is more personal, and that's because I have Viennese relatives. My grandmother was Viennese and was actually at university at roughly the same time as members of the Vienna Circle. So I had a very personal interest in Vienna of the 1920s and 30s.
So today, people often think of the Vienna Circle as apolitical, but many of them fled Europe to escape the Nazis. Was there something about their ideas that Hitler found particularly upsetting?
Yeah, they almost all fled Europe. In fact, only two of them remained in Vienna during the course of World War II. Most of them had fled by the time the Nazis arrived in 1938, but Austria had been under fascist control since 1934. I guess there are several reasons why the fascists and the far right opposed them. First and most obviously, at least a half of them were Jewish or, fully Jewish or of Jewish extraction. They were mostly, not all, but mostly they were socialists. And all of them were anti-metaphysics. And they were anti the metaphysics that was part of Nazi doctrine. So there were aspects of Nazi doctrine that they thought were untestable, unverifiable, unfalsifiable. There were various ways of describing it. And that made them natural enemies of the Nazis and the fascists.
So what's an example of that? Some metaphysics that the Nazis were fans of?
Well, for example, a relationship which the Nazis felt that the German people had to the soil, a sort of blood relationship to the soil, or the idea that there was a folk, that there was a people over and above the set of individuals within a community or within a country. They had this mythical idea of the German folk. And that was another idea which the Vienna Circle said was untestable, unverifiable. And so, as I say, they were very natural critics of the Nazis. And as soon as the fascists came to power in 1934 in Austria, the Vienna Circle was effectively closed down. It stumbled on for another few years. But, the first kind of endpoint of the Vienna Circle is 1934 and the arrival of the fascists.
I definitely see how those Nazi ideas are opposed to an anti-metaphysical worldview. Do you think socialism followed in any sense from the Vienna Circle's anti-metaphysical views, or was it just another commitment that a lot of them happened to have?
No, it didn't follow at all. In fact, it was a great controversy how you get politics back into the worldview of the Vienna Circle, because there were aspects of politics, namely normative values, that were themselves untestable, unverifiable. So it was a great problem for them why they should be of a particular political persuasion and not another political persuasion. And they had to try and smuggle politics back in. It's worth saying that the founder of the Vienna Circle, Moritz Schlick, whose name is in the title of the book and who was murdered in 1936, he was not a socialist. He was a conservative with a small C. And he was very opposed to the idea that the Vienna Circle should have a political agenda. But there was a left-wing faction within the Vienna Circle which moved into a Marxist wing. One of the main members of the Vienna Circle was a chap called Otto Neurath, who was a Marxist. There was a left-wing faction who was agitating for the Vienna Circle to take a political stance, and the leader of the circle, Moritz Schlick, opposed them on that. So they didn't by any means have a uniform attitude towards politics.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today we're thinking about the Vienna Circle, with David Edmonds, author of The Murder of Professor Schlick, The Rise and Fall of the Vienna Circle.
Should we always judge theories by their testable predictions? Where do we draw the line between sense and nonsense? Can logic help?
Science, metaphysics, and the limits of language, along with your comments and questions, when Philosophy Talk continues.
I was blind to your obvious faults. As we danced across the scene to the strains of the Wiener Schnitzel Waltz.
Today we're dancing to the Wiener Schnitzel Waltz. I'm Josh Landy, and this is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ray Briggs, and we're thinking about the lives and ideas of the Vienna Circle with David Edmonds, author of The Murder of Professor Schlick.
Moritz Schlick survived the Spanish flu, and we are making our way through COVID, which means, unfortunately, we're still pre-recording the program from the safety of our respective homes, and we can't take your phone calls today. But you can always email us at comments@philosophytalk.org, or you can comment on our website, where you can also become a subscriber and gain access to our library of more than 500 episodes.
So Dave, at the beginning of the show, Josh and I were arguing about whether a statement can be meaningful if it doesn't have any observable consequences. I know the Vienna Circle would back me up here. What do you think they'd say in my defense?
Yeah, we want to say probably that astrology is not science. We want to draw a distinction between science and astrology. So I read my, you know, if I read my horoscope today, it would say something like, I will meet a person who will open up new opportunities, or I don't know, I will suffer a temporary setback but overcome it. You know, the sort of
during this show.
Yeah. I've got about 45 minutes to achieve that. You know, the kind of rubbish you get in horoscopes. It's nonsense. And it seems to be of a different kind to the sort of assertion that a scientist will make. But we want to try and highlight what the difference is. It turns out that's quite a difficult distinction to draw. And it's one of the projects that the Vienna Circle set themselves, was to try and draw that distinction. You mentioned Karl Popper. Karl Popper, who was never a member of the Circle, but was associated with it, that was his main project, to try and draw a demarcation between what was science and what wasn't science.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And gee, we could do with that right around now, right?
Right.
One of the things I found fascinating in your book, actually, is that they didn't agree entirely among themselves, but it seems like psychoanalysis ended up falling on the side of pseudoscience, which gratified me. Can you say a little bit about that?
Well, Vienna, of course, was the home of psychoanalysis, and many of them were psychoanalyzed. So they were operating at roughly the time that Sigmund Freud was in town, and he'd begun the whole school of psychoanalysis. Several of them had psychoanalysis. Other philosophers from the UK traveled all the way to Vienna to get psychoanalyzed. A very, very important philosopher, Frank Ramsey, had gone to Vienna to be psychoanalyzed. So there were many philosophers who took psychoanalysis very seriously. The question was it a science? They were confused about this, conflicted about this. Wittgenstein, who himself wasn't a member of the Circle, but was a great inspiration for the Circle. Wittgenstein had a lot of time for psychoanalysis, and particularly for the writings of Sigmund Freud. The question was, could it be tested? If you made a claim about, let's say, the reason you put that rather aggressive question to me was because your mother had smacked you when you were 7 years old, well, in what sense is that testable? Are there ways of saying one psychoanalytic claim makes more sense than another? And what would the difference be between good psychoanalysis and bad psychoanalysis? So that was the debate that they had internally.
Right. I'm particularly curious about psychology because some of it seems like it's about biological things and drugs. But some of it seems like it's not about things that are as easy to manipulate as what chemicals somebody's taking. So parts of psychology that study how people's childhoods affect them in adulthood, for instance. It's not ethical to manipulate children to see if you give them psychological problems by stressing them out when they're kids. So if I have a theory that hypothesizes about how somebody's childhood affects them in adulthood, does it count as testable or not?
Well, I certainly think there are lots of ways you could test certain claims like that. So if you said that if you treated a child, if you abused a child in a particular way, there was a massively increased chance that they would go on to be abusive in adulthood. You could make that claim, and then you could look at stats, and we've got lots of stats now, more than we've ever had before, and you could see, well, does that claim
make sense? Is it borne out by the stats? Is it the case that if you've been abused as a child, that is predictive of whether you will become abusive? So I think lots of those claims do definitely fall within the scientific realm. Often people draw a distinction between science and social science. In other words, between the natural sciences, the sciences like physics and chemistry, and the social sciences, which are to do with human beings. And I think they're both within the realm of science. The only difference is the social sciences are much harder because humans are very complicated creatures, but they can be put in a laboratory and tested, or you can make these observations about them in various ways. So I think claims about human beings and the social sciences do fall within the realm of science and are open to various kinds of tests and predictions and falsifications.
So you're making a really attractive case for the Vienna Circle. I mean, this idea that we should combine empiricism and logic, right? Base your beliefs on observations you can make about the natural world, including, I guess, the social world, the psychological world, plus, you know, whatever follows logically from those observations. One of the things I found really intriguing in your presentation of it, Dave, is, you know, the claim that it's really relevant now, now in this age of fake news and post-truth. Do you think that, you know, we should be bringing the Vienna Circle way of thinking back? Can it help us?
I definitely think it can. I think they had all sorts of problems. So they tried to define what counted as verification. But I think the spirit was right, that they were trying to do something important, which was to distinguish between scientific claims and claims which had no link at all with truth or falseness, or just bad science. So, I mean, just to take an obvious contemporary example, if Donald Trump claims that at his inauguration ceremony, there were more people than there were at Obama's inauguration ceremony, he makes that claim and many people believe it. Well, I think we should take the claim seriously, and the claim is either true or it's false. And there are ways of assessing whether it's true or false. You can find out roughly in various ways how many people attended Obama's inauguration, how many people attended Donald Trump's inauguration. You can look at, there's photo evidence, there's all sorts of evidence that you can adduce to test that proposition. And people somehow shouldn't be allowed to get away with making those claims and them not being open to scrutiny. So, as you say, we live in a world of fake news. This is a new term, fake news, that we've always had propaganda. But we ought to be able to hold claims up, hold propositions up to the microscope or the magnifying glass and analyze them and be able to distinguish those which have some basis in reality and which can be tested and those which are just false or BS.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today we're thinking about the Vienna Circle with David Edmonds from the University of Oxford.
So, Dave, I wanted to ask more about verification. You said the Vienna Circle got themselves into all sorts of trouble about what looks like a pretty intuitive concept that you ought to be able to test something by doing an experiment. Why is that a troublesome concept?
Yeah, so it seemed like it was very straightforward when they first raised it. Something to be meaningful had to fall into one of two conditions. Either it had to be true in virtue of the meaning of the terms. So, for example, all triangles have three sides, all bachelors are unmarried men. You mentioned mathematical truths. That was a very interesting one because they really were puzzled about how to understand mathematics and whether mathematics was empirical or whether, as they eventually decided, inspired by Wittgenstein and perhaps by Ramsey, that mathematics had nothing to do with the world out there. It had nothing to do with observation. It was another linguistic conceptual domain, so that 2 + 2 = 4 was just true in virtue of the meaning of the terms. So there are those kind of propositions to do with concepts and language and logic. And then there were claims about the world, such as water boils at 100 degrees centigrade. So that seems like a very straightforward two-sided claim.
The problem was, what counts as verification? Just take history, for example. If I said that, I don't know, Abraham Lincoln ate a boiled egg on October the 5th, 1843 at 8:05 a.m. Presumably that's either true or it's false. He either did eat a boiled egg at that moment or he didn't. But there may be no data, no documentation to check whether or not that is true. I mean, perhaps there is. Perhaps a historian will ring in and tell me exactly what Abraham Lincoln was doing on that day. But assume there isn't any documentation about it. It doesn't seem to be a meaningless claim. And it, as I say, it seems to be either true or false, but it doesn't necessarily seem to be verifiable. So one issue was whether things are in principle verifiable or whether they are practically verifiable. And that was one thing they disagreed about.
So I actually have a question from a listener, which I think is meaningful, but I'm not sure whether the answer is verifiable. So Tim in Portland asks, what if Professor Schlick had taken another appointment and hadn't been shot? Would it have changed the development of logical empiricism had Schlick lived?
That is a very interesting question. As you say, counterfactuals, one doesn't know how to deal with them because was it possible that Schlick was not shot? If you're a determinist, and I have rather determinist instincts, actually, I kind of think, well, it was inevitable that Schlick was going to be shot at that moment, at that time. Did it make a big difference? It almost certainly did. Schlick was the key figure in the Vienna Circle. Had he lived on, then the Vienna Circle might have stumbled on a bit longer. Having said that, I mentioned earlier on that the fascists had arrived in Austria in 1934, and that was 4 years before the Anschluss and the Nazis arrived, but the Vienna Circle had effectively been closed down, and many of the Vienna Circle had already fled by the time Schlick was murdered. What was so interesting about Schlick's murder, of course, is how it was interpreted by the Austrian fascist press, who all welcomed it as a blow against logical positivism or logical empiricism. Sometimes it's called logical positivism, sometimes it's called logical empiricism. The two terms are more or less interchangeable. And Schlick, they said, was a Jewish professor, which was not true. He wasn't Jewish, but it was broadly welcomed in parts of the fascist press in Austria just because he was the main representative of logical positivism.
Yeah, that's horrifying. And it brings us back to the really fascinating relationship between the Vienna Circle and politics. As you said earlier, they officially were supposed not to have ethical and political stances. All of that stuff is technically speaking nonsense from their point of view. And yet, I couldn't help thinking, reading your wonderful book, that Otto Neurath ends up being sort of the secret hero. He's kind of a rock star, right? This guy who was involved in the Munich socialist government in 1919. He had this amazing museum for teaching even illiterate people important facts about society through pictures. He invented the isotype, these universally recognizable, understandable images. He said, words divide, pictures unite. He was campaigning in his own way against racism. Did you end up sort of developing a soft spot for him too?
Oh, I love Otto Neurath. I think it's a total scandal that there isn't a proper biography of Otto Neurath existing. So if there are any biographers listening, please write a biography of Otto Neurath. He is an extraordinary character. He's an economist. He's a political scientist. He's an activist. He's a Marxist. He has the most extraordinary life where he's constantly sort of on the run because he's both Jewish and a communist. That is not a good combination in Austria in the 1930s. He goes to Moscow and he has a hard time with the Stalinists. He escapes by the skin of his teeth when the Nazis enter Holland, because he's fled to Holland when the fascists take power in Austria. He then comes to England. He has the energy of 15 human beings.
Yes. Do you agree with, you know, we heard in Holly's Roman Philosophical Report at the beginning, you know, George Reich saying scientific thinking could have averted World War One. I mean, the manifesto of the Vienna Circle was calling for various reforms. Do you think, you know, if the Vienna Circle had continued to flourish, I mean, could you really get a good politics out of Vienna Circle thinking?
I don't think you could read off any politics from the Vienna Circle. What happened was that Moritz Schlick was thinking of leaving Austria in the late 1920s and decided to stay in Vienna. And to thank him, some of the other members of the Vienna Circle, including Neurath, who you just mentioned, wrote a manifesto. Schlick was really annoyed about this manifesto because it was an extremely political manifesto and he wanted politics kept out of Viennese Circle thinking. And partly because I think he was slightly cowardly about it. He was worried about the implications of getting too political, and quite rightly, as it turned out. But they wrote a manifesto for him, which was much more radical than he would have wanted. What some of the Circle get out of their approach to the world is a kind of utilitarian approach. So they can't derive many normative consequences, because the problem with saying, making ethical statements like murder is wrong, is that that is neither true by definition, nor is it open to being tested. So it looks like you can't get normative judgments within a Vienna Circle framework. So there were a group of Vienna Circle thinkers who went down a sort of utilitarian view and said, well, what you can do is measure whether people are happy. You can sort of quantify well-being. And so Neurath, although he was a Marxist, had a utilitarian dimension to him. And Karl Menger, who was an economist who was associated with the Circle, that's how he gets politics into the Vienna Circle framework. He becomes very utilitarian and he analyzes society by dimensions such as well-being.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today we're thinking about the lives and ideas of the Vienna Circle with David Edmonds, author of The Murder of Professor Schlick.
How did the Vienna Circle influence today's philosophers and scientists? Which of their lessons should we carry forward into the 21st century? Does philosophy have a place in a scientific world?
Philosophical foundations for the future, plus a conundrum from one of our listeners, when Philosophy Talk continues. Please stop doing metaphysics, said the Vienna Circle philosophers to anyone who would listen. I'm Josh Landy, and this is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ray Briggs. Our guest is David Edmonds, author of The Murder of Professor Schlick, and we're thinking about the lives and ideas of the Vienna Circle.
And we have another email from a listener. This one's from Nancy in Altadena. Nancy says, as I understand it, when early modern scientists began using the term laws of nature, it was a metaphorical way of saying that just as God has given laws to humans for their behavior, so also has God given laws that natural processes must follow. However, during the later modern period, for example, Laplace, the laws came to be seen as something of a force on their own. By the time we get to logical and neopositivists, the laws were mathematized wherever possible. So the laws came to entail logically, and therefore necessarily, the events that could be deduced from them. Is this anywhere close to an accurate account?
Gosh, you have some very intelligent listeners. Well, laws of nature, they were exactly the sorts of things that the Vienna Circle wanted to test. So, I mean, that's what scientists do, don't they? They derive laws of nature. They say, so long as the following conditions are met, you will get the following result if you do X, Y, and Z. And the verification principle said, let's see whether that's true. Let's see whether this particular law of nature holds. Let's test it. Let's test it again. Let's test it under new conditions. Let's test it again. And
if it occurred many times, well, that we could determine that law of nature held on planet Earth. Now, a number of things to be said about that. One is it's based on inductive reasoning. So you say you spot it once, you spot it twice, you spot it three times. You assume, therefore, the law of nature holds. Karl Popper's criticism was that there was a problem with the logic of induction. Namely that, let's say you say all swans are white. You see a white swan, you see another white swan, you see a third white swan, you see white swans everywhere. That seems to suggest that all swans are white. That's not quite a law of nature, but you can see the parallel with laws of nature. The problem is you might eventually see a black swan. And that's why Popper wanted to say that you shouldn't have verification, you should have falsification. That you should set up a claim about a law of nature or whatever, and you could see whether it held, and you could assume maybe it does hold until it's falsified. And Popper wanted you to be bold about that. The bigger the claim, the better, as far as he was concerned. The Vienna Circle didn't quite know how to deal with this criticism, but they ended up coming up with a view about confirmation. So they didn't say that something was proved if you claimed a law of nature and you tested it 1,000 times. That didn't prove it. But every time something seemed to support your scientific hypothesis, that provided confirmation. Not proof, but confirmation. And that led to a whole set of complicated arguments about what counted as confirmation, what confirmation was, and so on.
So it seems to be like a lot of scientific theories in the real world can't be definitively verified or falsified because a lot of them are statistical. So like even in physics, you have quantum mechanics making statistical predictions about sort of frequencies of experiment outcomes. And so if you see a frequency that doesn't match your theory, it seems like it could just be a fluke. So does that have to do with the move to confirmation rather than verification or falsification?
Well, I mean, yes and no. Quantum mechanics was fascinating for the circle, and it was precisely why so many of them got into the philosophy of science. They were writing and thinking at precisely the time that Heisenberg was coming up with the uncertainty principle, and you had Einstein's theory of relativity, and none of these were intuitive theories. But, I mean, there were lots of statistical claims that can easily be tested. So if I say, if I roll a dice, there's a chance of 1 in 6 that it will land on the number 4, that is a statistical claim which can be tested. So you can see over a large number of throws whether it does land 1 in 6 times. So they certainly also argued about the nature of probability. But probability claims can be tested in the same way that other claims can be tested. There are some problems where you talk about one-off events. So suppose I say there's a 10% chance that before this program ends, well, 10% is a bit of an exaggeration. Let's say I say there's a 0.00001% chance that before this program ends, the world will be extinguished. Let's hope it doesn't, because, you know, that will be the end of a great series. But
two great series.
If I make that claim, how do you test that? That's a one-off claim. And, you know, there is a big problem with that. So there are lots of problems with it. There's also, if I can just throw in one more, if you come up with something that seems to falsify a claim, it may be that that particular experiment was done under incorrect conditions, and that you want to stick to the theory and reject this particular case, which seems to condemn or falsify the theory. So that's an added complication, because sometimes it's just not simply the case that something which seems to falsify it does falsify it. It may be that you've got something wrong with the test tube, or the atmospheric conditions are all wrong, or something like that. So there were many, many complications. And what seemed like a straightforward project when the Vienna Circle started, you can already see, is full of complications.
Dave, you mentioned in your book that, you know, not every circle of philosophers of this period had women in, you know, as members, but the Vienna Circle did. Rosa Rand, Olga Tausky, Olga Hahn, and then Susan Stebbing in England was later influenced by it. Can you say a little bit about these figures?
Yes, it is interesting. I mentioned my grandmother. So she was another woman who was at the university at the same time. There were women undergrads at a time when there were very, very few women undergrads, you know, all around the world, basically. And these students were not just undergrads. They went on to get PhDs. And they themselves were fascinating figures. Olga Hahn was the sister of a mathematician called Hans Hahn, who was a key figure, one of the founders of the circle, and she has an interesting life. She goes blind very young, and she marries Otto Neurath, who we talked about earlier. Rose Rand had a very tragic life. She was an interesting logician who took sexist connotations in this, of course, but she took some of the minutes of the Vienna Circle, which became quite valuable later. Neurath wanted to get hold of them at a later stage, and she had a very difficult life, never quite finding an academic establishment that would take her. But there were these female members of the circle. They played a very important role, and it was interesting. They all had similar backgrounds, actually. So they were a Jewish assimilated background. So they were from families who believed in education, wanted to educate their daughters, wanted their daughters to get on, encourage their daughters. And that's why you get this surprising number of women in the circle.
Dave, if you wanted to pick one lesson that contemporary scientists and philosophers should carry forward from the Vienna Circle, what would you pick?
I think I would go for clarity. The Vienna Circle had many virtues, but one of their chief virtues was a desire to make everything as clear as possible. They were dealing with very, very complicated questions, very complicated philosophy. There's lots of squiggles and equations in Vienna Circle philosophy, which is very hard to understand. But they did their best to make everything as clear as possible. And that is something that we still see in Anglo-American philosophy today. And I think that's probably one of the most important legacies of the Vienna Circle, this drive to clarity. And their criticism of metaphysics and many of the what we now regard as continental philosophers was, it was often very difficult to work out what they were claiming. And they strove to try and make their opponents' statements as clear as possible. And when they couldn't, they sort of rejected them. But it was this drive to be clear, not to be pretentious, to be understood, which I think is a very important lesson. And I think that should be a virtue for contemporary philosophers. You know, I think that it's very anti-democratic for contemporary philosophers to write in such a way that other people can't understand them. Some of the best philosophers in the history of philosophy write beautiful, beautiful English. David Hume is a prime example. You can write very brilliant philosophy, and you can write it in clear terms that people can understand. And I think the Vienna Circle would endorse that message.
I couldn't agree more. This has been extremely clear and unpretentious, but also incredibly illuminating and inspiring. So thank you so much for joining us today, Dave.
I really enjoyed it. Thank you very much indeed for having me.
Our guest has been David Edmonds, co-producer of the Philosophy Bites podcast and author of The Murder of Professor Schlick, The Rise and Fall of the Vienna Circle. So, Ray, what are you thinking now?
So at the beginning of the show, Holly talked to George Reisch, and I would really recommend his book, How the Cold War Transformed Philosophy of Science to the Icy Slopes of Logic. So this kind of follows the next chapter in the lives of the Vienna Circle philosophers after they had fled Europe and immigrated to America and started dealing with America's own kind of Cold War politics. And it says both how this transformed them and how they transformed sort of some of the discourse in the US in ways that persist to this day.
Brilliant. I'm going to reread Dave's Wittgenstein's Poker, that other great book. And we'll put links to everything we've mentioned today on our website, philosophytalk.org, where you can also become a subscriber and gain access to our library of more than 500 episodes.
And now let's check in with a listener looking for a little philosophical advice. It's time for a conundrum. Dan, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Thank you for having me.
Where are you calling from, Dan?
I'm from Davis, California.
Excellent. So what's your conundrum for us?
Well, I have a friend whom I admire. She's a thoroughgoing vegan, and she aims to be consistent in her veganism, but she keeps a carnivorous pet. And I think every time she feeds her dog, how can she do this? Well, she's not eating meat. She's giving her dog meat every day. And so I thought, is she being inconsistent or am I being too harsh?
Well, that's a doozy. Ray, you have a dog, a lovely dog named Blossom. Do you feel guilty about this? What's your take on this?
Oh, yeah. I absolutely feel guilty about this, but this has not compelled me to behave in a consistent way. So I just try to reduce the amount of animal products I consume rather than trying to abstain from consuming animal products. And one of the things I just consume, not for myself, but for my dog, is dog food. and so then I think, like, I'm being inconsistent about this. But at least I'm being better than I would be if I tried to be consistent. So I could be consistent in a way that I guess like the best way to be would be to be consistently vegan in every aspect of my life. And then I either am not able or not willing to do that, which is definitely a flaw in me. And your friend sounds more admirable because she's just consistently vegan. But then if you can't be consistently vegan, maybe it's better to be inconsistently mostly vegan rather than consistently not caring about animals at all.
Right. The perfect can't be the enemy of the good, right?
I like that way of thinking about things. I mean, I remember reading a stat about how much of a good impact it would have on the world just if people ate meat one time less per week. You know, and so I wonder, I'm very tempted by this. Not that we should lower our standards for ourselves, but, you know, maybe your friend would be really lonely without dogs and her life would be so much the worse that, it would be harder for her to do all the other good things that she does contributing to the world. So,
that's one thing I've noticed is she has an excessively happy pet. So its utility is very high. It makes her very happy, and it's small. So maybe this is an argument for if you got to keep a pet and it's carnivorous, keep a smaller one so it's going to eat fewer animals than it would otherwise. My friend has one other factual argument. She says dog food is mainly byproducts, and so these were animals that were being killed anyway, and this was food that was or flesh that was going to waste because humans wouldn't eat it. And so that's another argument that's
a good consequentialist argument. I mean, I've got a friend who is a vegan but will wear secondhand leather shoes,
right?
Because he didn't cause them to be made, and I can see the argument there.
Right. So actually, I mean, no animal product that you buy is one that you caused to be made because you're buying it as downstream from it being made. I think there is like a really interesting question about what is your causal impact when you use animal products? Because you didn't kill that animal, and maybe you made it more probable that one more animal would be killed by creating a market for it. But it looks like it really looks like this is a collective harm that's hard to pin on individuals, but still kind of messed up to participate in.
I'm feeling better and better about your friend, Dan. I've got to tell you, she's a wonderful person. She's a strict vegan. She buys the pet food that's mostly made of byproducts. This is a small pet. It makes her happy, fills her with joy.
Yeah, she's definitely a better person than I am. So that's not the question. Is she being consistent? And I guess maybe if you set your ideals high enough, it makes it harder to be consistent. So that's the price you pay for lofty ideals.
Yeah, I liked what you said about not letting the perfect be the enemy of the good. And I also, one thing I said to Josh when you sent your question in was, look, do you want to be consistent or do you want to be better? Because sometimes that's the choice you have.
Right, right.
Well, Dan, I hope that we've provided, and I hope we haven't sounded like we judged your wonderful sounding friend. And I hope we've
brought some clarity in this really interesting and difficult topic.
This is helpful. This is helpful. I appreciate it. And keep up the good work.
If you've got a conundrum that's got you in a bind, a dilemma in your personal life that might benefit from some philosophical insight, send it to us at conundrums@philosophytalk.org. And maybe we can think through it together.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of KALW Local Public Radio San Francisco and the trustees of Leland Stanford Jr. University. Copyright 2021.
Our executive producer is Tina Pamintuan.
The senior producer is Devin Strolovich. Laura McGuire is our director of research. And Cindy Prince-Baum is our director of marketing.
Thanks also to Merle Kessler and Angela Johnston.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from various groups at Stanford University and from the partners at our online community of thinkers.
The views expressed, or misexpressed, on this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders.
Not even when they're true and reasonable. The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org, where you can subscribe to our library of more than 500 episodes. I'm Josh Landy.
And I'm Ray Briggs. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.